Talking amongst themselves.
No.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. All right. Well, welcome, everybody. This is something we're sort of repeating from last year, which we're repeating because I thought it was quite fun and it went well. This is sort of just a very casual opportunity to continue the conversation and ask the questions about freedom and rationality that we've been talking about so far this year at camp. But of course, with the morning sessions, there's always those times when you just can't quite get the question in that you wanted to ask, or the comment that you had to make, you know, we ran out of time, so we couldn't really talk about that aspect of it. So this is kind of just a catch-all session to talk about various questions you might have about freedom and rationality. And what I have done is I have gone out to all of you and I have collected some of those questions, which I will this afternoon. These guys have not seen these questions, so they're going to be put on the spot here. And I'm going to be, you know, asking these questions to various members of our esteemed panel here. I would like to say that, yes, this panel is here to give their best understanding of these questions. But my hope is that we're not just here to hear these guys talk. If any of you have some thoughts on these questions, please, please feel free to raise your hand and we'd love to hear your take as well. One last thing I will say before we begin is, you know, I look up here and I kind of feel like up on the stage here, it's almost like they're in a dunk tank or something, waiting to get dropped. So my thought was that, you know, one of the things the writings say about the clergy is that one or two of the evils that we need to be aware of is the evil of dominion. The clergy's got to watch out for that. And the evil of the love of self-intelligence. So while this is for your sake, you know, for their sake, my goal here is to try to stump these gentlemen, try to make them look like fools, you know, try to ask them some questions they just can't answer to, you know, bring them down a level. Which is why I am just asking the questions and decided not to sit up there myself. No, I'm kidding, of course. So I think we'll just go ahead and get started with our first question here. And we'll start with something rather light and casual. And maybe I'll address it at Brad since he's
the casual guy. Certainly not light.
A classic question, somebody asked me this just this morning. We often hear that animals, my pet Fido, dog Fido or whatever, doesn't go to heaven because animals do not have freedom and rationality. So their question was, do animals have some level of freedom and rationality? If so, how is it different from human freedom and rationality, and how might it be the same? The example they gave was, well, a dog can sit there and make a decision whether it's going to bite somebody or lick them. That's freedom. So do animals have freedom and rationality?
I'm going to say no. Sorry. I think they have Pavlovian response. I think they have trained things that temper their instinct, but I think that ability to elevate yourself into the spiritual realm, and thus rationality is the ability to see the ratio between the spiritual and the natural, and then make a choice, and I don't think animals can elevate into the spiritual to see the ratio between the two. And so I really think it is on the plane of natural instinct that could be tempered by training.
Good.
And yes, I do think you can see a representation of your pets in heaven, and they'll be better than the pets you currently have. Because it'll be all the fond things you remember about them minus all the bad stuff.
Good. Anybody want to ask a follow-up question on that?
What about accuracy of
I think that is, what the writings, I believe, teach on that is that human beings have, we're not born into any knowledge. We have to learn all of our behaviors, and I think animals, as it were, are pre-programmed into the order of their life with certain instincts, and I think animals, dogs in particular, are pack animals, and there is, you know, desire to protect what is one's own, that kicks in, and it can look like an altruistic choice, but I wouldn't say it's freedom and rationality.
A what? Say louder.
An infant.
An infant.
Like what age?
No, are you
mean an animal protecting an infant?
No, I meant
that doesn't happen.
If you're talking about some being that doesn't have any preconceived thing, like a dog, an infant is being born without any rationale.
So what's your question?
If that's your line of reason.
Yeah, an infant, I don't believe, is born with rationality. They come into that.
Correct. So, what you're saying, that's similar to pets?
No, I think pets are born into the full knowledge that their instinct of their lives that they're going to have.
Yeah.
An infant has the potential to come into
rationality. Yes, that is a good distinction. Just because you're human doesn't mean you will become rational.
I want to say that I was always under the impression that the difference between men and animals is that we have a soul. And Bradley always wants to add an eternal soul.
Mm.
Yes, I would say in the human soul, those capacities of freedom and rationality capacities are inherent. And you will develop that rationality if you choose to follow the Lord.
Yeah.
I thought this was the light question.
I know. But, excuse me, Derek, before...
Hands about pets, Peter would be...
You know, I joke here that this is sort of a light, get-us-going question, but I will point out that the writings address this question quite seriously.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in the world today, there's this thing called naturalism where, you know, people do have this tendency to make people on the same level as animals. And that does matter in the way we view life and eternal life and what we're here to accomplish. So it is a serious question, although it's a fun one too. So, Derek, go ahead.
So I'm going to start treading on some scientific, philosophical stuff, which is dangerous ground for me to tread on. But my understanding is that one of the distinctions that scientists have discovered between people and animals is what you can call the theory of mind. The idea that I know that you know something and you can share that knowledge with me, which also means I know that you have feelings or thoughts apart from mine that I could learn or share or have communication with. And animals don't have that ability to recognize that you have something you can share with me. And, you know, even a 1 or 2 year old will start to get that I can, you know, communicate things that they don't know already. And so I think that's sort of a building block for rationality that an animal never is able to have. You can train them, you can teach them, you can help them. They have desires and understanding of things at a certain level. But there's a kind of communal relationship that I call love of the neighbor that they don't have a full capacity to develop because they don't know that this other being has its own mind and has its own feelings and own experiences. And the human ability to share that and communicate that and love this other being with these other experiences is a very, very profound thing.
That animals do not have, yeah. One thing I would just quickly add is there's a great quote, and somebody correct me if I'm getting this wrong, that points out that because human beings are born into no knowledge to start with, they are therefore capable of eventually over time to eternity of entering into all knowledge. Obviously, we never become perfect in that, but we can continue to grow in knowledge to eternity. Because animals, as Brad was sort of pointing out, are born into the knowledge of what they are and what they're meant to do as that animal that they are, they're kind of stuck on that just natural level of understanding that they're born into. So, Brett, and then let's take one more question out here or comment and then move on.
On the more unsavory side of the animal-human comparison, over and over and over in the doctrine, the Lord says humans are like beasts when humans follow their most central corporeal, I don't think he used the word instincts, but heart desires.
Desires, good point.
So the one place that humans, or area that is most prominent in the Hemidoc about the comparison between humans and animals, makes it clear what we're doing when we're acting like animals, and we are not engaged in any sort of weighing of ideas of a rational activity. So that's just another piece of the puzzle.
And it even says that they're worse. We are worse than animals when we're in that state.
Yeah. That reminds me of, you know, that very much ties in with, I think, Brad's punchline this morning in terms of his presentation. If you were remembering, he was talking about how one of the most important abilities we have as human beings is the ability to compel ourselves to do things that our natural self does not want to do, or to compel ourselves not to do things that our natural self wants to do. And I suppose it'd be fair to say that animals don't have that ability. They just do what they naturally want to do. One more, maybe? Yes.
I don't really have a question. I'm deaf in one ear, and if we really want to dump these guys, I think it would be helpful if people spoke loud enough so that we can hear the questions.
Great.
From back here, especially the people in the front, if you could turn sideways.
I will also try to repeat the questions if I'm remembering.
Thank you.
Dorothy.
So you changed that for me. But we've all heard stories about dolphins budging people up to land, and that seems to go beyond the packing thing. So you don't have to answer that. I'm just saying.
Interesting.
We don't hear the stories of them budging people out to sea.
Yeah, Dorothy's question was, you know, what about instances, for example, with dolphins, where you seem to hear dolphins and other animals doing some pretty wonderful things to help humans. And, you know, I just wonder myself if that's just a sign that, you know, even though these animals may not have eternal souls, the Lord's still using them, you know, in fantastic ways and stuff. All right, let's do one more and then let's move on. So definitely last one.
In cases like that, I wonder, maybe spirits are working through the pets, the animals, to perform things that the animals can't do on their own.
I think there's a possibility there.
They do each have a correspondence.
Yeah. Yep.
And one of the things I've wondered about is the Lord's presence in animals is in some ways more direct. Like their soul is much more directly tied to the Lord's presence and influence, because they don't have to be other. The reason we have an other and a separate and eternal soul is for the sake of loving the Lord and being separate from Him to be able to love Him in return. But animals are sort of a direct expression in some ways of the Lord's presence. Mm. And their souls are a capacity to receive the Lord sort of more directly and less separately. I'm not sure how much that's from the writings or my understanding of it, but...
No, I like that. There's something about nature, I think, as a whole that is just so moves us, because I think it is within the Lord's order. And, you know, somebody actually made that point, I think, as human beings, we have the capability of bucking the Lord's order and choosing not to stay in it. Maybe animals are so beautiful in that sense because they are in it regardless of what they're doing.
I don't think you see animals engaged in a lot of worship.
True. Right. Let me just maybe close this and ignore my father-in-law's hand. by pointing out, maybe to your dolphin question, it is interesting if you read the scriptures, stories like the story of Balaam, Balaam's donkey. Interesting, the Lord used this donkey that turned around and spoke to Balaam and basically said, why are you hitting me? You know, and all right, go ahead, real quick, real quick. Yeah.
And people have real relationships with animals. People have some sort of loving relationship with animals, and the animals at least seem to be returning that. Yep. I think that's an important thing to acknowledge. We talk about spirits operating through them, we talk about the correspondences, but they are embodiments of actual spiritual affections. Animals correspond to affections, they're embodiment affection. I think they've got to be part of the affection they embody. Is in the case of a pet, it's going to be something real for the people who are involved with that.
Yeah, that's a great point. I remember talking to him about this before, and I was expecting my conservative father-in-law to back me up that, no, your pets don't go to heaven. And he looked at me and said, oh, no, your pet goes to heaven. And it was sort of to this, not quite. It was sort of to Brad's point as well, that you might very well see an embodiment of that affection that you had for your natural pet in the spiritual world.
Oh.
Yes, correct. All right, let's move on here. I will point out, by the way, that I asked my father-in-law to be on the panel, and he said, no, I'm much better at just lobbing bombs from the back. So that's what he's going to be doing for us. All right, our dear assistant bishop hasn't spoken yet. So I thought that was going to be an easy question. Maybe not. So maybe my hard question will be an easy question. But this is a great one. One that, you know, I have my own answers to, but I also sometimes struggle with in moments. In this world, we are free to choose between heaven and hell, right? We know that. This is a world of choice where we're determining what our eternal home is going to be. This person was simply pondering that age-old question that goes something like this. Life in this world is so short, and is it really true that after you leave life in this world, somehow, on some level, that freedom to choose does go away, because as the tree falls, there it lies, as a quote says from the writings. In other words, after death, if you've chosen heaven, you can no longer choose hell. If you've chosen hell, hell is eternal. You can no longer choose heaven again. So I don't know if that's a question per se, but just maybe thoughts on why that is so and how we deal with that sometimes difficult teaching.
All right, so I hear eternity of the hells.
Eternity of the hells, yes.
I hear all kinds of different things in that. So,
pick what you want.
Yeah, many of us have probably all fielded that question in some ways before. I guess what I boil it down to from my personal standpoint is the Lord's pretty basic in what he asks us to figure out in this life. You get into the two essentials of salvation. Is there a God? Does that God tell you not to do some bad stuff that hurt other people or to be other-oriented? It's basically all it is, the two great commandments. And he gives us plenty of time in this life to figure out those two basic things. Is there somebody else who created me and has something to say about how I live my life? Am I supposed to live for myself, or do I live for other people? And, you know, when we think about that same God who's saying that that's what is really at the heart of whether somebody is able, has the capacity in themselves through their life choices to choose to go to heaven, we also have to remember that the Lord's pretty darn good at getting people there. Leading people there, giving them every opportunity to make that choice. And the other thing that comes to my mind is when we go into the next life, we're free to choose heaven or hell or anywhere we want to go. Nobody's telling us, you have to go here and I don't want to go here. We go where we want to go. So any evil spirit in hell is welcome in heaven. They can't stand it.
That's a good point.
Any angel in heaven conceivably could be told that they can go to hell for a little while.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be able to stand it. Why would they do that? It's contrary to their nature, to what they, who they are and who they like to associate with. So, you know, we could go in so many different directions with that question, but the Lord is really preserving freedom. It's just that he leads us to a point where the freedom is sort of fixed. We've made those fundamental choices and we're back beyond it. Sort of like if I was to look at myself or talk to my wife or any of you, would you really like to go back to being a 13-year-old and going through that whole process again?
Woohoo!
We may be able to identify and rejoice in what's going on there and be supportive in the good and the bad and the awkwardness and all that kind of stuff, but we've moved beyond it. So why would we go and relive that? So I think similarly, most of us have every opportunity to hear from the Lord that we are supposed to be other-oriented, to come in tune with some of the things that aren't other-oriented in our lives and to do something about them. And that's just our status of living. We're not going to just sort of backtrack and be a different person or regress to an earlier state in the next life. We're going to move forward based on that. So I think that has a lot to do with we're free to go wherever we want, but we're not going to regress to earlier states. We're going to move forward.
Let me throw two quick things out there, not to be answered now, but just in the course of the conversation. One thing that I sometimes challenge people with is the thought that, well, if hell is not eternal, you've got to also say that heaven is not eternal, which is just to me sort of an interesting thought. So can an angel that chose the celestial heaven a few hundred years down the road change his or her mind and go to the lowest hell? Again, interesting question. And with what Pete was saying, I think he was skirting around this a bit. Well, then what about kids? You know, sometimes people ask, so a two-year-old dies or an infant who was just born takes a breath and passes away. I know somebody, some people here in this room today have had children who've moved on far too soon to the spiritual world. So what about them? Where is their freedom involved in terms of choosing heaven or hell for themselves? So I'll let that float out there for others to answer. Jennifer and then Lee. Yeah, absolutely.
Unless we just say a person like that remains in a state of innocence and goes to heaven because they're like a child their whole life. I don't know what
the truth is. Does somebody want to speak to that?
Just on that one, I have one of those angels in my midst, and my household is 21 years old now and is not that in her mental state. But thought a lot about that, Jennifer, and would just say underscore that I believe that the platform is reestablished in a way that it can't be in this world and the next life, and she gets to make the choices from there on out. Mm. And her quality will be childlike, but it'll be a different kind of childlike than somebody who hasn't experienced the years of life that she has. So, totally, there's some unfinished business kind of concepts that can go on in the next life, but the fundamental you still remains, good or bad.
Is this to this question? Because I want to get to Lee. Okay, so this and then Lee, I'll get to you.
It's important to remember that little children don't become angels when they die.
Good. Say that louder.
Little children do not become angels when they die. They are raised by angelic mothers.
Yeah.
And they only become angels after they grow up, and they choose freely. become angels. And even in that process, they are let down into their lower selves to experience what it would be like not to choose heaven.
Yeah.
Yes. They have that free will.
Now, I remember, though, as a high schooler, this always bothered me because, yes, but it also says, but every single one chooses heaven in the end. It's like, wait a second, that is there really free choice there? But no, I think that Pierce makes a very, very good point. And please remember that, you know, a little child that dies, as he said, does not just go right to heaven. They first need to be raised by angelic mothers and make those choices, as he said. I think the answer is a little bit of both. I've read passages that say yes, but also at times it seems like they come down, as Pierce said, into the world of spirits, maybe, but...
Well, there's also no going to heaven.
Yeah.
There's quote writings, in no way can a person say that heaven is a place outside of the person.
Yeah. Yeah,
so they are with angelic mothers, and those angelic mothers have heaven within them.
Yeah, good. Yes.
Well, I always had ministers teach me that we make the choices here on earth. And you don't make the choices after we die. All we do is drift around and find the community that we're most comfortable with.
Yep.
And that's the deal. And we can't, but then somebody talked about fallen angels.
Yeah.
So y'all explain that.
Yeah. Brad?
I tried.
Well, there are a couple of thoughts on that thing. I think there are also passages in Heaven and Hell that talk about the fact that actually none of the choices that we've made in this world are what determine where we go, that we choose in real time in the next life where we want to live. Now, the fact is that those choices we're going to make are based on our pattern of choices that we've developed in this life. But you won't go to hell because you murdered somebody in this life. You will go to hell if, when you're there, you continue to choose revenge and murderous behavior in whatever circumstance you're faced, and that is why you will end up choosing hell. So it's those decisions we make determine where we go. And then I think the other thing that Pierce is touching on is, as it were, when we cast our lot is when we come in through that state of the world of spirits into our infernals. And that child doesn't do that process immediately. For adults, we take a longer or a shorter time to get stripped of our externals and come into our internals, and that's when we follow the path and we choose where we want to go. But for young people or people with challenges, I would say that state of coming into their internals might be a longer process before they're ready to make that rational and free choice to choose heaven.
One thing I would add, I think answering your question a bit, is that I'm fascinated with the teachings and the writings that point out how little we know of ourselves. You know, we don't know other people that very well, and we think we know so well who we are, and yet often it seems to indicate that we don't. I mean, can you tell me what your ruling love is? You know, everyone, name your ruling love, quick.
Cheesesteak.
I thought from last year it was cookies, Pierce. I remember something about cookies. You've evolved, okay. So to that point, I think it's, you know, again, it's not so much that we're making new choices in the other life as it is that the Lord's helping us to discover who we've actually chosen to be. It's almost a surprise to us, like, oh yeah, this is who I am. after all the natural stuff has peeled away. I saw Eric first, I think, and then I'll go to you two in the back. And then over here.
To the question of why we have a different kind of freedom in the natural world than spiritual world, I think it's the same question as why the natural world exists in the first place.
Mm.
Because we're told it exists as a seminary to create angels. And it exists, I mean, what it is, it's something that's stepped away further from the divine, which I think is part of giving more freedom. Mm. So we have the freedom to organize our mind, meaning like to choose which love is subservient to which other love, because we're further away from from the divine, then we can organize something in a way that we can't.
Very true.
When we're not, when we don't have that same degree of separation from divine order.
Yeah, you say separation. Another word the writing uses is that this world acts as this termination point or this base. And as soon as we are not making conscious decisions in that most natural foundation of a level, that's when our choices become fixed. So we've got to be here in this natural world to be doing that. So Jane, and then Kari.
So the Lord won't let us die unless our choices are fixed.
Next question, please. No. That's a great question. You know, it goes down to, you know, providence and the children who die and things like that. And, you know, not that this is faith alone, but I for myself, my answer is that there is a little bit of just faith involved with the fact that I believe that the Lord really does make sure somehow that everybody has what they need in order to make that eternal choice. I might not be able to explain how that one had it, or how that person, or the person who was just horribly abused during their life and just never seemed to, how it works. I just sometimes have to believe that it works. And it's a tricky question, though. Interesting. Now, interesting, are you saying, though, that it was saying within the same kingdom?
I think it was kingdom.
Interesting.
I just,
that
was interesting.
That is neat. Yeah. That, I think, actually brings up a really important point. You know, we talk about where the tree falls, so it lies. Let's please remember that beautiful teaching that says, wherever you end up, because God is eternal, there is potential for eternal growth. I mean, it's not like, don't have this vision that, okay, you just found your little box where you're going to now be forever. I mean, to you, in that box, yes, it may be one little piece compared to all the other places in heaven, but you have the potential to grow to eternity and to be perfected to eternity wherever you are. Oh, wait.
He was next.
Oh, sorry, he was next. And then I'll get you. Go ahead.
I understand the whole concept that we talked about children.
Mm-hmm.
And we understand that process. And I understand there's challenged people, too, that go through a situation that they're really not, really haven't made all the choices possibly that really amounts to the where they're going to go because of their problems. And they may have the opportunity to clear that up in the other world. My question is there a sort of a set of guidelines that someone up there is using that is somewhere passed on to us in the writings that gives us what they're using? Because I sort of question the fact that, can I use the thing, I'm going to plead insanity?
Right. I didn't know any better.
We also, just was mentioned, we really don't know ourselves, so can we plead ignorance?
Right.
You know, and have a chance. So there's...
Good question.
Some of us are not.
Yep. Does anybody want to try to address that, Derek?
Yeah, what's the difference between ignorance and humility?
Knock, knock.
It's sort of answering his tongue-in-cheek question tongue-in-cheekly.
Okay.
If, you know, pleading in ignorance in a true sense is humility. Say, I honestly don't know myself. There's so much in me that I don't know. And at the same time, acknowledging that the Lord is governing and I need him. And I think that's sort of the ultimate sort of answer and solution for everybody is a reliance on the Lord, Jesus Christ. And to the extent that we turn away from any level of evils, you know, like I love the, you know, those who give a cup of water in the name of the disciple will receive a disciple's reward. That the Lord's standard is very little, and there's so little that he asks of us to really do, and he's so merciful in the way he does it. And so what is the difference between ignorance and humility? Just the recognition that you're ignorant. Mm. That's humility.
Interesting.
So yes, you have to plead ignorance. You have to be humble.
Are you ignorant?
Absolutely.
Brett and then Pete.
I don't know if this gets another aspect of your point, Gil, but there's a series in Divine Providence in the late 200 that lists specific states in which reformation is not possible. The Lord's very specific right there. He talks about mental illness. He talks about impairment of the mind. Yep, illness of the body. And states we are all very familiar with as soon as we read them. So I don't know if that's kind of the guideline that he tells us. You can't be reformed in those states, and I think the other piece of that is if you're in that state for your whole life, then that reformation process, like we've already discussed, somehow you get a little, and he gives us a lot of clues on that. But if you can read that verse in that passage, it probably doesn't apply to you, so I just thought you had a deal with
right.
Matthew, tying on to that and what you said as well is the that section of Vastation, the 10 plagues and the Arcana that
11 plagues
that process makes again and again the statement that nobody ends up in heaven or hell until they are entirely convinced, entirely beyond a shadow of a doubt that that's where they want to be. And so we have to trust that nobody's going to wind up in hell and look around and say, how did I get here? They're going to be there because they understand that's what makes me the happiest I can be based on the choices that I've made. And that, I think, is really important. And the other one is the Book of Life stuff. The writings are pretty clear that, you know, ultimately the choices that the Lord is looking at, the former character, the ones that we make, where those two things, freedom and rationality, come together. And we think about it, we reason about it, we make a choice in freedom. That's a choice. But the Lord knows internally those areas in our life where maybe our freedom's been compromised, or our rationality is compromised, then those aren't the choices that are going to be forming our book of life.
Yeah.
It's the other ones.
Pete, did you want to add something?
Sort of along the lines of what Brad said, so I'll shorten mine. Just to remind us that the God we worship is the Lord God, the Savior, Jesus Christ, and he's about the saving business, and so he's pretty good at it.
Right.
And just from that standpoint, I hear a lot of the questions, even the pet question and the concept of can we have it be fair that everybody has a chance to get to heaven. Well, the Lord's got that covered. He's going to make sure that everybody has that opportunity. And I like what Brad was saying just about reestablishing the playing field for all these limitations that we have or are done to us in our life. And what are the litmus tests, the sort of inner meanings of the writings that give us the, what are you based on? They're the face and hands passages. Do you treat others the way you'd want to be treated? Are you living according to the Ten Commandments? Are you loving the Lord and loving your neighbor? That's really what it is. The rest are the details. And if we can figure those kinds of things out in this life, we're going to be fine. We may be better off if we really are diligent about it and searching ourselves, but I hear people saying, is it fair? And the Lord's pretty fair about this salvation.
Yeah. One thing that I liked about what Pete was just saying there, the word that came to mind is the simplicity of it all. I find that sometimes we way overly complicate. Did I make the cut? I mean, when you leave life in this world and arrive in the world of spirits, it's not like taking the bar exam, is it, Brett? I mean, okay. Let us know.
I certainly don't want to take it.
We make it out to be this big, complicated thing. One of my favorite memorable relations is where somebody arrives in the world of spirits, and it basically says, I think that they're a little bit worried because, you know, they no longer have a job and a way, you know, how am I going to find food in this new world and all sorts of stuff like this. So these wonderful angelic spirits meet this newly arrived spirit from this earth and explain to him that in this world, the Lord God is our Heavenly Father and He provides all things for us. And this newly arrived spirit, it says, immediately lets all those cares go away and begins wondering, how can I repay such kindness that these lovely angelic spirits just offered me? And I might not be getting it quite right, but it basically says that immediately that newly arisen spirit went to heaven. I mean, that's what it was about. Okay, good. You love your neighbor. You care about the Lord. Come on up. And there's other great passages like that where, you know, it's just so simple. The angel asks in another passage, do you believe in faith? Yes. Do you believe in charity? Yes. Do you believe it's the same thing? You've got to live the life of charity? Yes. Come on up. I mean, so... Yes, one last one, and then let's move on, or two more.
It is not so difficult to live the life that leads to heaven as is believed.
Yes, perfect. Lisa, and then let's go. Sorry, I never got back to you. Lisa, go ahead, and then. Yeah.
Oh, no one's going to hurt me. You know,
absolutely.
You know, and there's some sort of healing that has to do. It isn't necessarily going to affect your choice because of who you are, but you kind of have to adjust to being in this new, totally different place. Like, I sort of envision the world of spirits is that place for some people.
Yeah. I agree. I think that ties into what someone was saying just about even coming into a state of your internals. Even if you're a good person, it takes a little bit of time to come into that state where you no longer have any ability to put on a false face. I mean, just you're fully now inside and out who you are. So that's a great point. Stephen, and then let's move on to another question.
This actually goes back to your previous about
the... Go ahead. Oh, interesting.
So there was a lot of transitions.
Moving around. Good point. Okay, let's move on to another question here. Time flies. We're not going to nearly get to all these questions. So if you asked one, I apologize if we're not getting to it. Skipping down a little bit, I thought this was an interesting one. Very simply put, can anyone take away your spiritual freedom? You know, maybe this ties into Brad's point that, well, everybody can will what they want to and think what they want to, and yet you can't necessarily do and say what you want. But is that really true? Can I do anything to Jamie that really is going to harm him on a spiritual level because it's somehow hurting his freedom and his rationality? I mean, my answer to that, I kind of want to say, well, yeah, on some level we can hurt people spiritually. I think that's true, but how deeply? So is the question. Does anybody on the panel want to just take a stab at that to start us off?
Well, basically my answer is sort of yes, we can. The Ten Commandments on their deeper levels are all about how
good
we do these things to other people or can do these things to other people. And on the deepest level, how we try to injure the Lord. So I think that there's some damage we can do to other people's relationships, and the Lord tells us don't do it. So if he's telling us don't do it, I think we really can injure other people. And there's also a passage in Arcana which talks about the torn, which are people who have been damaged by teachings of religion, such as faith alone, so that they're no longer able to resist their desires because I'm already saved.
Hmm.
They don't know that their choices are the part of their salvation process. And so they no longer have that protection of truth, that the choices I make are going to matter and do matter. And that the Lord knows that these people have been damaged in this way and does care for them and protect them. But they have been spiritually injured. They have been spiritually damaged by that process.
Yeah.
So
possible, yes, definitely, is your...
Matthew, I would make a distinction between, you said injure, you said take away. I think the Lord
Good.
Is clear that you cannot take away someone else's spiritual freedom. You can injure
it.
And there is a big difference between those two.
Good distinction, yeah. Tor?
I think you have the ability to injure or damage someone else's freedom and rationality, but only to the extent that they let you. I think Viktor Frankl is a great example.
Yes. Remind us who that is.
He was a Jew in the concentration camp in Germany. And, he came to see the guards.
That's right.
Rather
than himself. Yeah, very powerful.
I think the idea that we can think and will anything, I think, can damage our own spiritual freedom. Because my understanding that we are responsible not only for our acts, but also for our deliberate thoughts.
Hmm.
And if we're thinking deliberately evil thoughts, we're harming ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the classic example is something like anger. You know, anger is hurting yourself much more than it is hurting the person you're... I love that. Yeah, any of those things. Pete, did you have something?
Well, in one sense, it's an easy question to answer, saying yes, because the Ten Commandments do, on the deeper levels, command us against injuring people in spiritual ways, spiritual murder and other things. But I think in the harder times of life where we think about actual times where people inflict terrible suffering on other human beings, you can look at abuse situations where so much of a ripple effect is affected in one person's life by another person's consistent evil in their regard. And one of the most powerful demonstrations I had on that in my training was somebody just, it was in a domestic violence kind of situation where every time somebody limited somebody else's freedom or isolated them or told them something terrible about themselves or hurt them, was like putting a covering on them. So, you know, you have somebody with thousands of coverings on them, and the path to health is needing every single one of those to be taken off.
Mm.
So I think that just for me showed me the reach into somebody's psyche, into their brainwashing, into their whole way of viewing the world and interacting with other human beings, that's pretty intricate and pretty far-reaching, and how merciful and wise the Lord and angels need to be and people in their lives to help weave out of that. So I think the effect that we can have on other people is pretty profound, which is why the Lord says it's part of those Ten Commandments. Do not do that.
It's kind of neat that layering effect made me think about whether the doctrine of remains very much applies here, where we're given that beautiful concept that remains can definitely be covered over, but the Lord always protects remains within people on one level where they can't be touched.
And I would agree with that.
Yeah. So maybe that's kind of to your point too, Jamie, where you can't destroy remains. You can certainly cover them over and make them a lot harder to come to the surface, but you can't destroy them. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I had these questions ahead of time, so I looked up a passage, I cheated, that I wanted to read. And let me read it now, because I don't want to end with this passage because it's so horrible. how many in this room are parents? Some of you might be familiar with this horrific passage. It makes you think about, you know, how we're doing as parents. Not that we should feel too guilty about the mistakes we make, but we read in Heaven and Hell, from what has been said, it can be seen what child education is in heaven. Namely, that it is leading them by means of an understanding of truth and the wisdom of good into the angelic life, which is a life of love to the Lord and mutual love, in which is innocence. But how different, in many cases, is the education of children on the earth can be seen from this example. Is everybody sitting down? I was in the street of a large city and saw little boys fighting with each other. A crowd flocked around and looked on with much pleasure. And I was told that the little boys are incited to such fights by their own parents. Good spirits and angels who saw this through my eyes so revolted at it that I felt their horror, and especially that parents should incite their children to such things, saying that in this way parents extinguish in the earliest age all the mutual love and all the innocence that children have from the Lord, and initiate them into the spirit of hatred and revenge. Consequently, by their own endeavors, they shut their children out of heaven. Wow. Where there is nothing but mutual love. Let parents, therefore, who wish well to their children, beware of such things. Now again, wow.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. I love... Very hard passage, and you know, you've got to, I think, always remember the opposite side of that, that as parents, sometimes we can be way too hard on ourselves, I think. You know, the evil spirits love making us think that we've been horrible parents and stuff when we really haven't been, but that's a tough passage, boy, to say that we really can have the effect on people, you know, that it's tough. Eric, and then...
I think maybe you can read that two ways, like either they're shutting them out of heaven at the moment or shutting them out in eternity.
Yes, and I would definitely read it in terms of the former. I agree. I don't think this passage is saying that I am capable.
That's the question.
Oh, sorry. Eric was saying that you could read that two ways, almost saying that, well, you're shutting them out of heaven almost temporarily, or you're shutting them out of heaven for good. And it's really the former. You know, we can affect their spiritual lives for a time, but there's always that freedom there. And there's, again, where I would say remains come in. No matter what, if I'm the most horrible parent in the world, I think the teaching is still my children will get remains from the Lord somehow that can be used. Yep.
This is tongue in cheek, but I don't know why it hit me, but a spiritual half full or half empty question. The Lord is continually leading us to saving. So the question is, do writings indicate whether there's more people in heaven or more?
Anybody?
Why do people always ask that?
I
want to know what our odds are.
Okay? Yeah. No, I have a legitimate reason for asking that. I mean, I'm not saying it's a good thing.
I would say at the time of the last judgments, of which when the writings were written that was going on, there are a number of passages that seem to indicate that the numbers he saw were more choosing hell than heaven. That was now. How many hundred years ago? Spiritual freedoms restored. What are the numbers now? So, but yes, there are a couple passages at the darkest times, at the times of the last judgment, where it indicates more people were choosing hell than heaven. I think that's part of why the Lord had to come and restore the order. So what the odds are now, I have no idea.
Somewhere, did you have a follow-up to that?
The reason I asked the question is, I realize in myself, depending on what day it is, if I'm
connected and looking at it, the Lord's doing a great job, then my spiritual glass is half full.
Hmm.
And I don't have to worry about how many people are going to hell. I just have to worry about myself. When I'm not in that state and I'm looking at it from the world is a terrible place and all the terrible things are going, and I'm not, it's how the hell is attacking to say, how's the Lord really doing?
Yeah.
And so I ask it in a tongue-in-cheek question, but it influences me anyway about on any given day how I think it's working.
Yeah. Oh, that's a very good point. I like that.
You can take me offline.
Yeah.
Chastise me a little.
Well, I like the way Jesus Christ answers that question. He says, narrow.
Better than the way Brad answered it?
Well, I think his is pretty good. But Jesus said, strive for the narrow way, because narrow is the way, and few find it. So he sort of answers the question, but he also turns it back and say, it's possible.
I can't stand it.
I was going to say, go ahead. You maybe we have the same thought.
That may be true, but I think the Lord's also telling us that it's the way it appears.
Yeah.
That everybody's going down the path to hell, so I might as well go that way too. But I don't think that, in my mind, there are more people in hell than in heaven. I think the Lord's way too good at being a savior, and he gives us a broader perspective about so many planets out there that are far better than ours. We're pretty external, and we've got some work to do. And even then, I have a hard time believing. I used to argue about, not argue, but there was a lovely old lady in Glenview who is still with us. She's 100 years old now, who is convinced that she and everybody else is going to hell. And I was trying very hard to convince her that she had no problem. But it led into everybody goes to hell. No, not everybody goes to hell. I'm a cup half full person.
Well, and that's why I asked the question, because I think it has a direct influence on all the questions about having our thoughts, whether they're good or evil, and then but not acting on them in terms of other people judging other people or that kind of thing. So
the thing I also liked about it, which I didn't mention, was that it's
I see you. You're next.
Pushing you back to thinking about yourself.
Yeah.
Which is what you were saying, is when you're in a better place, you know, it is work to get to heaven, but, you know, you strive for the narrow way.
Yeah.
I
want to be aware that there's a couple minutes left, so I want to take a couple more questions, and then I think we will end, but I just want to quickly read through the other questions we had just for fun. We had Deacon first, and then I'll come back to you, Jamie.
Mm. Ruined for eternity because now they're in hell forever, because we know they can't change now. So it's not saying that because, you know, the way the spiritual world was, those people who were not in the freedoms that we have now are now, you know, screwed forever.
I love that question.
Assumptions being made there are, were they compelled to go to hell, or did they freely choose?
What if they didn't have pure freedom, because that's why the Lord came to earth? And they were
but that's part of that vastation process that they go through. They're not ending up there unless they're interiorly convinced that that's where they want to be.
Hmm. Jamie?
I just want to remind people that, as I understand it, we are not actually responsible for the thoughts that come into our minds. The angels and the devils, evil spirits, put those thoughts into our mind.
Yeah.
What we're responsible for is those that we want to entertain and think about and dwell on. So when
make
those
own
bad thoughts come into your head, you can just say, oh, that's an evil spirit, get away from me. But when you say, ooh, I like that, I want to do that, that one you're now responsible for, and that's taking it to yourself.
Yes, good point. All right, let's do one more here, and then we got to wrap up. Okay.
Just thoughts on Deacon's question. I've thought about that, and I wonder if, you know, the Lord from eternity knows the choices we're going to make.
Mm.
If it makes any sense to think of it in terms of what time, what era are you going to be born in, and what, you know, if you're going to be born into a time where you'll make the choices that are going to lead you to the best place you could be. I mean, so maybe those people aren't the victim of the time they were born in. Maybe the Lord's providence let them be born then, because that would be the best time for them.
See, that just gets into so many fascinating time space. That's where my finite mind starts to implode. No, but I think that's a great question and point. So let me do this. I'm going to just, there's about, and then let me do the, is it on this topic?
Yeah, okay. It's on specifically that question, which was the compelling internal, can the internal be?
Right, can we harm people's internal spiritual freedom?
Just DP 136, and I'm only throwing this out there because I'm not quite sure what this means, but it terrifies me. DP 136 subsection 2, and it is in the handout I gave you, but I specifically did not go over it this morning. But the internal may be compelled by the external not to speak ill of the laws of the kingdom, the moralities of life, and the sanctities of the church. Thus far, the internal may be compelled by threats and punishments, and it is so compelled and ought to be.
There you go. All right. On that note, let me just read the other questions we had. I just sort of think it is fun to, you know, hear what other of your fellow campers have been wondering about. So these are the questions we did not get to. Do people in hell have freedom and rationality? We talked about that a little bit, but not that one specifically. The writings speak extensively about the equilibrium that is vital to our spiritual freedom. Did people who lived in most ancient times have this equilibrium before they chose to fall and turn away from the Lord? A question here about that fine balance between freedom and rationality and our own prudence being so important, yet passages that also say human prudence is nothing. It's like dust compared to the divine providence. So how do we walk that fine line? This one actually came up last year, and it's a question I love discussing, so please talk to me about it. Does the Lord know the future? Mm-hmm. Classic question. This touches on what Eric said. Does the Lord know what choices you will make? Does the Lord know where we will end up after death?
Yes.
If the answer, which I also believe is yes, how can we still be free? Great, great fun question to talk about. Another really interesting one, I wish we had time for. This is getting pretty deep, though. Was the Lord free to do evil in the world? The Lord was born into this world, and in the process of glorifying as human, he went through the same process that we went through. So we know that the Lord did not make any bad choices, but then did he really have freedom to make a bad choice?
Yes.
Interesting. All right, well, let's talk about that later. Let me skip down to just a couple more. When our life is cut short due to circumstances beyond our control, has our freedom to choose our eternal home been affected? I guess we kind of talked about that. How do various addictions affect our freedom and rationality? Drugs, alcohol, even addictions like anger and arrogance. This was an interesting one given by Mr. Taylor, I believe. Is he here still? Maybe not. Does new church education rob our children of their ability to choose the church freely for themselves? Interesting question.
That's a leading question.
That's a leading question. I had a neighbor once, I told him when he asked me this question, who told me, you know what, Matthew, I just don't talk to my children about God at all, and I will not read the Bible to them. They weren't new church. You know, because he somehow felt that that would take away their freedom to decide for themselves whether they wanted to believe in a God eventually or not. So I still don't think the new church education question is interesting, because I think there's legitimacy to it. You know, how do we make sure that we are teaching our children in a way that is encouraging them to think about these things for themselves eventually? So I think that is a legitimate question. And following from that, how do we, in a related way, introduce new people to the church? in a way that is allowing them to use their freedom and rationality. And last but not least here, I've got, how do you love your church, your country, if you do not agree with what it is doing? And somebody also asked, and what about your church? Pete talked about this, I think, a little bit in his elective. You know, obviously the church is imperfect, and so how do you have that free and loving relationship with the church when you don't necessarily appreciate what it's doing? So again, there are more, but that's just a taste. Thank you all very much for coming. I feel like we could have done this for a couple more hours. It's always very fun. Thank you to these guys and for all of your thoughts as well.